Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motor Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back, News Radio 1070 WKOK on this Wednesday. Great to have you with us. Tomorrow, Vince Welsh will join us from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway to talk about the Indy 500. Yesterday, very pleased to have had on A guy that really has put together a legendary resume in broadcasting, and that's Paul Page, the voice of the Indianapolis 500. He was on with us yesterday. Vince Welsh, who's a good friend of the show, and will do the pit reporting again for ABC on the call of the race a week from Monday, is going to join us from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway tomorrow. Kurt Smith, Voices of the Game, the author, will be joining us later in the week as well. Tomorrow, Tony Knopp, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, will talk about the business of sports again. Tony is, we have him on once a month. He's our go-to guest on this when it comes to the business side of sports, and has turned out, despite the fact that he makes Kevin squirm in his chair about that sports is a business, he's actually become one of the more popular guests among our audience, without question. We get so much reaction to having Tony on the show because Tony talks a high level as to how it works, and at the same time, he does it in such a way that everybody understands. You can't ask for better out of a guest than that. Tony DeFazio, Pittsburgh Sports Report, on later in the week as well on the show. This half hour, Charlie Wilmoth will be joining us to talk about the Pirates. He's a blogger for the Pittsburgh Pirates. Greg Pickle, Fight on State, in the final half hour of today's show. One quick addendum to what Josh Moyer and I were talking about in the previous half hour, Josh from ESPN.com. And I've talked about this at every stop that I've made so far on my speaking tour. I've gone to Maryland, I've gone to Ohio, and a couple of other spots here in Pennsylvania. I got Scranton tonight as well. And it is, I think, the biggest factor that I've seen in all of this that has, I found to be remarkable. We could talk about the job Bill O'Brien did, which was great. We can talk about how the players stuck together, which is great. Because if that doesn't happen, it doesn't generate the passion around the program. And now what James Franklin is doing, James Franklin is taking the excitement of the program to another level. And there's Scranton tonight, the room seats just over 900. That's all they're allowed to put in. They literally turned away between 400 and 500 for a ticket request for tonight. They turned away between 400 and 500 for ticket requests tonight. So James Franklin has generated that kind of juice. But let's get back to the fan base. And I've told in each speech that I've made so far that I think that that's the one of the areas that the NCAA counted on, that by attempting to go the route of crushing the football culture at Penn State, and that was, you know, they talked about the football culture, which was one of the great insults I have heard at a high level, that wasn't answered right away. I answered it right away because it made my blood boil. This program over the years, all right, until July 23rd, 2012, hadn't had a sniff of the NCAA being around, was graduating players at a remarkably high level, some years just over 70%, other years near 90%. The recent graduation rate is at 88%. While winning football games. I've watched players leave practice repeatedly early. Why? They had class or had a test. They weren't told to stay at practice. They were released to go to the practice of the test because that is the priority of the culture. And then there are the fans who embraced the priorities of the culture, that it's a university first, that it's a classroom first, and it's a great football program next. and that great football can have great academics. That has been the culture of Penn State University. And what the NCAA thought might happen is that by crushing this with sanctions that were like putting a head in a vice, is that you, the fan, would say, the heck with this. It's a mediocre product. I'm not going. And I think they thought there would be 40 to 50,000 people in the stadium by now. Instead, they averaged 96,000 plus tickets sold per game last season. You, the fans, during all of this, have been absolutely unbelievable and cannot get enough credit from me. You've been unbelievable. You've been the big to me of all the great stories that have been that have come through this, and there have been a lot of great stories. You're one of the biggest, if not the biggest story to me. When I sit up in that booth and look out and see 72,000 people at a blue-white game, because the difference, because you don't want to know why? All of you get it. All of you get it. You're the ones that actually get it. You're the ones that actually get it. All right. Let's talk about the Pirates struggling. Charlie Wilmoth joins us. He is the blogger for the Pirates, also working for MLB.com. Charlie, welcome. Great to have you on for the first time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, over the first 6 weeks of this season, when it comes to the Pirates, exactly what have we watched?
We watched a team that is not as good as last year's team, and that's the simplest way of putting it.
And why is that?
Well, I think that the pitching staff caught lightning in a bottle a little bit last year, and they don't have the same talent, especially in the rotation that they once had. Losing A.J. Burnett hurt a lot. Depending on Edinson Volquez to fill that spot in the rotation hurts a lot, and we've seen a lot of guys take steps backward with their velocity as well. I think the position players, by and large, have not really been the problem. I think it's mostly been in the pitching staff.
All right, let's talk about this for a moment in terms of the money part, Charlie. I don't think anyone expects the Pirates to pay A.J. Burnett $16 million. I think what they offered him, personal opinion, was actually the right kind of offer based on where he is in his career. But still, they got
out. Go ahead.
No, Charlie, if you disagree, say it. I want to hear it. Go ahead.
Well, I disagree. I think that A.J. Burnett's certainly an older guy. I think there's maybe, an argument to be wary about him based on his age. But based on his performance last year, I think he was probably worth, $20 million or so in the open market. And when the Pirates had the opportunity to pay him to extend him a qualifying offer worth $14.1 million, they, should have considered taking it. And it was surprising to me that they didn't, given that it was just a one-year offer. Based on them not extending the qualifying offer, there could be other reasons for that. But essentially what happened in the offseason was that they didn't want to pay him that much money because they didn't have much of a budget for offseason signings. And I think A.J. Burnett at 1 year and $14 million is totally reasonable and something they should have taken.
I'm glad you disagree with me. That's good. I like that. No, seriously, okay? Your insight's invaluable here. Now let's go to the next part, right? You play a game here with Polanco as to when you can bring him up in terms of starting his clock. What kind of message does that send to the fans?
Well, I think that front office is not going to be concerned about the messages sent to the fans. It's going to be concerned about winning baseball games and whether it's winning games in a way that are cost effective for its budget. I think actually with Polanco, the problem is what you're doing is you're taking him to arbitration 4 seasons instead of 3. And so if he's not a very good player, if he turns out he's not a very good player, then it doesn't really matter. Having him this extra 2 months this year doesn't really matter between mid-April and mid-June. If he does turn out to be a really good player, keeping him down until mid-June could save the Pirates about $15 million in the long run, $10 to $15 million. So what you're looking at doing is potentially paying $10 to $15 million for 2 months of baseball in between mid-April and mid-June, and that just doesn't seem to be that great of a use of money for me. I mean, it prorates to $30 million to $45 million over the course of an entire season, and I can't see any team. I'm not sure that's a great deal for any team, honestly.
Understand that completely. From a business point of view, completely agree. Now let's have a little fun here and take it from a different point of view. All right. How about the point of view of last year being a perfect example? You don't get many opportunities to win it.
Right. I think that's fair. I mean, and I think, but I think that even within that context, you have to look at the broader financial picture. So if you're going to spend that extra, I think they should spend that extra money. But I think they should have spent it on somebody like Burnett.
Right.
Which would have been a more cost-effective deal for them over the offseason, rather than 2 months of Polanco, who might not even be, you know, the first 2 months of his career, he might not even be that good at this point at the major league level anyway.
Could be, right. No, and you're absolutely right. Very well could be. See, this goes to the argument, something Dick Girardi and I talk about on Penn State basketball all the time. When coaches take out a guy the second they get the second foul, well, what says that you are going to pick up the third foul? So what says that 3 years down the line it's a $15 million thing? You know, nobody knows that. It's all a guess.
You're right. It is all a guess. But then the flip side of that is if Polanco is not going to end up costing the Pirates a lot of money in arbitration, it will be because he wasn't that good the first
right.
3 years.
Right.
So the only way I can get this gamble to make sense, the calling up Polanco early gamble to make sense, in my mind, is if he is a very, very good player right now, but is not likely to be one in 3 to 4 years. I mean, that's certainly a possibility. It certainly could play out that way, but it doesn't seem like the most likely possibility.
Jose Fernandez has become the latest pitcher to succumb to Tommy John surgery. It looks like that's the path he's going to be on. Which is too bad. I mean, he's an ultra-talented pitcher. Ironically, Million Dollar Arm comes out this week, and Rinkyu Singh, who pitched here with the State College Spikes, is also out right now with Tommy John. When you've talked to people, why the apparent rash of elbow ligament injuries in baseball? Does anybody have a theory on this that you've heard?
There was an article, I forget who wrote it, that came out this weekend that quoted a bunch of former major leaguers, basically saying that people are more sensitive to it now. So what would happen in the past is that guys would just pitch and pitch and pitch and blow out their arms, and they would be like, just, you know, walk it off, you're fine. And their careers would be over at 30, and then nobody would really have a great reason why. And now we're finding out why, getting those guys surgery. It takes them out for a year, but usually they come back, and they're just as good when they come back. So, I mean, I think it's probably that, plus just a really abnormal number this particular year, and I'm not really sure why that is.
I mean, rub some dirt on it. Come on. Let's go.
Right. Mm-hmm.
What do you enjoy about your job? This is interesting how you got involved in this. How did you get involved in this, and what do you take out of it that you really enjoy?
You know, I started writing about the Pirates in 2004. And that was a really miserable time to be a Pirates fan. And, you know, what I was doing was really just writing like emails to my friends and family about all the stupid things the Pirates were doing at the time. And it just seemed like, you know, instead of keeping this on them, I could just send it out to the world instead. So that's when I started writing a blog. And I think for the first 2 years, it was kind of fun just as a sort of self-righteous young man. To write about the team at that time because they were being run so badly, and it was just fun to, you know, just be an angry guy online. I kind of grew out of that at a certain point, and that's when the Pirates hired Neil Huntington. And I think that, you know, although things didn't improve at the big league level right away, it was a lot more interesting to see them building a team over the process of several years, and you saw that culminate last year. So I think that the sort of team building aspect of it became really interesting to me starting in 2007.
Interesting, because I mean, I remember when they signed McCutchen. I thought that was one of the great moves that they made because it sent a message to the fan base. Did you feel the same way when they did that with Starling Marte?
I think both those moves are great moves. Yeah. I think that the reason you want to sign those guys is because they're young, athletic guys who are not likely to get hurt or decline, you know, seriously hurt or to decline steeply over the course of those contracts. And you may see them blossom the way we've seen Andrew McCutchen blossom the past 2 years since he signed that extension. He was a great player before, and now he's one of the very best in the game. And I think that was an outcome that it wasn't set in stone or anything like that, but you know, you could see it coming a little bit because there's just nothing wrong with his game in any way. So I think both those were fantastic moves.
Yeah, no, agreed. So absolutely agreed. The farm system, they've done a lot of work with the farm system, and we saw some of it here in State College, obviously, in the 6 years that State College was an affiliate. How have you felt about the development of the farm system and the route that the Pirates have taken in all of this?
I think that the route they took, the way they spent all this money from 2008 through 2011 in the draft and in Latin America, was exactly the right thing to do. I think you can debate how effectively they spent the money that they did spend, and a lot of it, you know, of course, when you have prospects, some of those guys are going to be turned out to be busts. But you know, a lot of their draft picks did not turn out as well as you hope, but they still ended up with a whole lot of talent in the farm system, and you know, that's not nothing. I mean, if you remember when the first couple of years the Spikes were an affiliate of the Pirates and Dave Littlefield was in charge, and you had a lot of guys who were much older playing for that team, were not prospects, and a farm system that just generally was not being taken seriously, and now it's taken seriously, and that's been an important part of the Pirates' resurgence.
Obviously, the key is to somehow make sure that within the division you're competitive. They're in a division that certainly has some depth to it. Of the teams you've watched so far that have come through and played against the Pirates, which one looks impressive to you 6 weeks in?
Well, I mean, the one that has played the best so far clearly has been the Brewers way out ahead right now in the Central. But I think the team that has the most talent is the Cardinals, and they're really a model organization in terms of developing their own players, just churning out young pitching. And so they're certainly a franchise for the Pirates to look up to, and I think probably the franchise that's going to be on top of the NL Central by the time the year's over.
Okay, now moving forward, what do the Pirates need to do over the next week? We talked about the opening six. What do they need to do the next 6 weeks, Charlie, to make sure that they don't get themselves out of this thing and still are in the depth of it?
Well, I mean, you know, not to be overly simplistic about it, but just win some games. I mean, and the starting pitching starting up, starting pitching pulling itself together a little bit more, getting more out of Garrett Cole, getting more out of Francisco Liriano at this point in the season, that's really important. And then, you know, hopefully getting everyone healthy, but I mean, I think the key to this team is going to be with the pitching staff, and we haven't seen nearly enough out of the pitching staff so far.
Yeah. Is there any concern to put strain on the bullpen because they're not getting mega innings out of certain guys? You really want to have at least two guys in your staff consistently give you seven innings, and they don't seem to have that.
Yeah, and I think that is, you know, somewhat of a concern, and we've seen a little bit during the season as they've sort of shuffled through bullpen guys like Casey Stadler and Jarrett Hughes, that they're trying to, you know, keep the workloads of their bullpen in check. It's especially problematic because this year's bullpen has not been quite as reliable as last year. So last year it seemed like there were a lot of games where the starter would go seven innings, and then you'd have Mark Melancon and Jason Grilli finishing out those last two innings, and there was almost just no question about it at all. Whereas neither the starting pitching nor the bullpen really have been that reliable this year. And, yeah, I think that the workload that the bullpen has had to deal with, particularly given some of these extra inning games, really is a part of that.
Yeah, this is also a team that leads the majors in walk-off wins, ninth-inning wins. I mean, what does that tell you when you see that?
I mean, it tells you that it's an entertaining team. It has not been the best team so far this year, but it's certainly been an entertaining team, and they had another opportunity for a walk-off win that they just sort of didn't quite pull out on Sunday. But it's been a team that there have been some fun wins to watch, but also a team that's been very frustrating.
Well, we appreciate the time very much. Thanks so much for carving out a little bit for us today.
Thank you.
That's Charlie Wilmoth, who covers the Pirates. I know we have to get some Phillies coverage in. We're going to get that in for you over the next week and talk more about the Philadelphia Phillies. We're off to an interesting start in an interesting division, so we're going to shift east here and talk more Phillies baseball here down the road. Coming up, Greg Pickle, Fight On State, final half hour of the show on News Radio 1070 WKOK.
Sunbury Motor Company has been satisfying more customers and selling more cars since 1915. Have you ever sat back and really thought about that? For almost 100 years, Sunbury Motors has been here for you. Four generations strong. That alone won't make you buy your next new Ford from SMC, but that reputation, plus these deals, will. Buy a brand new Ford Fiesta for only $12,810. New Focuses start at $15,915 at Sunbury Motors. SMC has always been the dealer you think of if you want a new Ford truck. Brand new 2013 F-150 crew cabs are discounted $9,600, starting at $34,939. If you want to buy a new Ford, it's really pretty simple. A 99-year reputation of satisfying customers, the largest Ford inventory in six counties, and thousands of dollars of savings makes SMC your preferred Ford dealer. Sunbury Motors Ford in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury. And at sunburymotors.com.
Sunbury Motors.
Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Welcome back. Final half hour of the show, News Radio 1070 WKOK. Our thanks yesterday to having Paul Page on the show from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So far today, we've heard from Josh Moyer, ESPN.com, and we've also heard from Charlie Wilmoth, the blogger for MajorLeagueBaseball.com and the Pittsburgh Pirates. Greg Pickle in just a few moments from Fight On State. Tomorrow, Vince Welsh from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway will join us. He'll be the pit reporter again for ABC's coverage of the Indianapolis 500. Kurt Smith, who wrote the book Voices of the Game. And in Voices of the Game, by the way, highly, highly complimentary of the work of Harry Callis. And we'll talk to him about Harry and Richie Ashburn and the entire gang. By some, there's some of you, who have longevity in life that remember By Some, which I always thought was one of the classiest things I ever heard. By Some had broadcast the Philadelphia A's in the waning years of the A's in Philadelphia when Connie Mack had taken the team and they had nothing. I'm talking they. You know, Bob Prince used to have a saying, you win 54, you lose 54, it's what you do in the other 54. The Philadelphia A's were so bad that they barely got to their 54, which meant they were 0-54 in the 54 you're not sure about. That's not good. So that's what he had. And then when the A's left and went to Kansas City, he then was hired by the Philadelphia Phillies. Well, we all know the history of the Phillies. They were formed in the 1870s and didn't win their first World Series until 1980. Hey, that's 100 years. Which meant there was a lot of frustration and very few appearances. I think, 1950, Jim Constante and those guys made it to the World Series where they were beaten by the Yankees. I think they were swept by the Yankees in 1950, and then didn't get back to the World Series, didn't get back to postseason play till 76. That was really it in terms of Philadelphia Phillies history. Well, By Some goes from the A's, who had nothing in the latter years of Connie Mack, zero, awful, to going to the Phillies, who may have been better than the A's, but better meant no postseason play. Well, By Some retires in 1975, never doing a Philadelphia championship. In 76, the first year he's retired, the Phillies win the National League East. Harry Callis and Richie Ashburn did one of the classiest things ever. The first night the Phillies had a chance to clinch the division championship, they asked By Some to come back and be a part of the announce team that night so he could be a part of announcing a championship moment. And they won that night. But that's one of the classiest things I've ever heard. That's part of Kurt's book, by the way. We're going to have Kurt Smith on later in the week, Voices of the Game. Also, later in the week, we're going to have on Tony DeFazio from the Pittsburgh Sports Report. We're also going to have on Tony Knopp, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, about the business of sports. That's coming up tomorrow, and we're looking forward to that as well. All right. So, and of course, plenty of continued Penn State football talk. I'm going to be part of the event in Scranton tonight where they're going to have over 900, a packed room. They turned away, as I said in the previous half hour, between 400 and 500 requests for tonight. Between 400 and 500 requests turned away for tonight. That's the kind of juice this is generating. My understanding is that for all the stops, when you take 17 stops, the average, not the average, the total number of tickets sold is 6,500 tickets for this. Tonight it's going to be Erica Wallace, the women's soccer coach, Kale Sanderson, and James Franklin in Scranton this evening. So looking forward to it very, very much. And a guy that's been following the caravan very closely is Greg Pickle of Fight On State. Hi, Greg. Welcome back.
Steve, glad to be back as always. Thanks for having me on.
Any nuggets as you've gone through the caravan deal and the get-to-know James Franklin situation, not just for the fans but for the media as well? It seems like there's a little bit more that comes out every day about personality and so forth. What have you learned about him?
Yeah, you know, I've only been able to make the state college stop so far, but obviously there's been a lot of, you know, 5-6 reporters at each stop. So you've been able to sort of piece the picture together. And I think what we've found so far about James Franklin, just reading all the different accounts, is that he can answer just about anything you throw at him, and he usually has some sort of coherent answer for everything. I mean, I think that's one thing that really stands out about James Franklin, whether he's talking about, you know, potential upgrades to facilities, whether he's talking about academics, whether he's talking about recruiting a specific area. He's incredibly good at narrowing his focus and narrowing the message to, you know, the desired outcome. And I think that with that, he's able to, you know, maybe give a little bit more than Bill O'Brien was in the past, who kind of was very broad at times during these events, whereas James Franklin sort of narrows it in very well. So I think that's one thing we've learned. And I think the other thing is that just, you know, his personality is such that, you know, he's very easy to communicate with, both for fans and the media, and I'm sure the team as well. And I think that at the end of the day, you know, if there was ever, I don't think there really was a reason for it, but if there's ever any doubt about that, I think it's certainly gone now after he's been on 4 or 5 stops here, the coach's caravan. Of course, they get rolling again tomorrow. That this guy is a very good communicator, and it's not just recruiting. It's in every aspect of the running a football program. And I don't think that should be lost in the fact that, you know, he's making, you know, 3 stops a week, because I think that's a big takeaway from this. I really do.
There's been a perception for a long period of time that Penn State has great facilities. I don't think there's any doubt Penn State has really good facilities. Yet he made a point about upgrades that are needed to get it to SEC standards. What were your thoughts when you heard that?
Well, you know, I think it's a very interesting thing. And when you look into what he said, and when you look at SEC field, you know, the one and facilities, the things that really stand out, you know, branding. He talks about that a lot. I believe he mentioned it specifically. If not, I'm sure he would if asked, because when you look at these SEC buildings, you know what they represent, what they are. And at Penn State, they're more sort of modern. I mean, you see the Aluba Hall sign if you go in the back of last, but I'm not totally convinced if you drove in, you know, totally unaware of what Penn State football was, that you would be aware that that was the football complex if you were behind the bushes and the gate was locked. I mean, I think that there's some facial upgrades, if you will, that could be done to just make it more personalized that this is Penn State football and that's where you're at. So I think that's something they would look into that sort of has that SEC mindset. We know Bill O'Brien spoke about the idea of eliminating one of the fields outside, and then he sort of found out that it was actually a benefit. So I'm not sure we're looking at that so much, but it seems a lot of it is, you know, I believe he mentioned James Franklin did some holes and couches in the facilities and whatnot.
Yes.
So it seems more,
yeah,
you know, appearance-wise is what they're looking at, which I'm sure every program everywhere could use that, and Penn State's no different, whether it's been publicly expressed before, you know, the last couple of weeks or not.
Well, let's get to the branding part of it. Because,
you know,
I've always felt, to me, that inside Haluba Hall, let's start there. You walk in there, and it's 2 practice fields. I've always felt that you need to take advantage and brand it. I'm talking like let them know how many Big Ten championships you have, how many national championships you have, and I mean include all of them, right? Now, Beaver Stadium is more difficult. College Township has a signage. I mean, the reason there's no signage on the back of the scoreboards is College Township. Okay? Pure and simple. It is College Township. Okay? So don't sit there and think it's Penn State or he's going to wave a magic wand. It is College Township that has kept the back of the scoreboards, for example, putting any branding on there. So there really is a mixed bag as to what they can and can't do.
You know, I think Haluba Hall is interesting, and it's funny that you mention that because I have mutual acquaintances, a daughter that plays field hockey, and they came up to Haluba Hall for a tournament, totally unaware, outside of the region, not overly familiar with Penn State football. So I walk up to go see the daughter play, and the dad says, well, what do they do here? What is this place besides where they, host field hockey tournaments? And I think, it's not something you think about. You explain that it's the place where the football team practice and sort of go on your way. But I think that you make a good point, Steve, that, if you're not immersed in Penn State football, you very well may not be aware of what some of these buildings are that are related to Penn State football. So, yeah, I mean, I think that's exactly the message that James Franklin's trying to drive home. And, you're right. There are some limitations, some administrative tape that limits some things, but others it's just a lack of not being done. And I think we'll see those things get done with James Franklin in charge.
I remember when they pulled the old AstroTurf out of Haluba Hall. They replaced it with field turf. I had said to somebody there, I said, why don't you take it and cut it into 2x3s and sell them as mats? I said, after all, the 1986 and 1994 teams practiced on that field. They never did it. They rolled it up and threw it into a garage. Yeah, that stuff I don't get.
Right.
Yeah. So that's just me. All right. Draft over the last few days, plus the signings. Carson ended up signing with Arizona, Gress with the Steelers, and Gilliam with the Saints, with the Seahawks. Okay, so that's six guys. Your thoughts on how it played out?
I think it played out just as we thought it would. I do think John Urschel went a little bit earlier than I think a lot of guys thought. I believe he had a seventh-round draft grade from NFL Scouts and CBS Sports, so I do think he probably went a little bit earlier than many had expected. Allen Robinson dropped a bit, but so be it. I think that, he was there was always a lot of receivers in this class, and I think he was just as likely to go earlier than he did to go when he did. So I think that probably makes a lot of sense. I'm not surprised that Glenn Carson was quickly locked up. I mean, even if he doesn't have all the measurables to end up being a starting middle linebacker in the NFL, he certainly has, the determination and the drive and the measurables in another sense to play special teams and maybe start his niche there, similar to Mike Zordich did last year before he injured his ACL. So I think it played out just like we thought it would, Jones went off the board early in the fourth round. That went as scripted. Robinson went on the first day. The second day. That went pretty much as scripted. And, some guys have signed. There's obviously a couple that still haven't. Matt Lehman, some of those guys that are still out there looking for homes. But for the most part, Gary Gilliam has immense potential. Whether he realizes it or not, we'll find out over the next couple of months here. But, he had the chance to probably do something with Seattle, and I think he believes he has the chance to do something. Adam Gress will head to the Steelers mini camp. And, hey, Mike Farrell went that route last year. And I believe he most recently got cut by Denver. So,
yes.
Obviously, he was banged up a little bit and got cut by the Broncos. But it seems like that's not a bad place to start, of course. So I think that, I don't think there are any surprises. I think that what we expected to happen happened, and we'll have to see, once these mini camps and summer camps get going, where some of these guys land. But Robinson, Jones, and Urschel, other than Urschel going a little bit earlier than maybe some expected, really wasn't a surprise.
In recruiting, Penn State has locked up, 16 verbal commitments so far.
Right.
It's been rare when Penn State's had double digits locked up at this particular time. It's happened before, but it's been rare. What are you seeing with what they are doing in recruiting that impresses you?
I think it's just the idea that the guys at the top of their board are the guys they're getting. Brandon Wimbush, the quarterback out of New Jersey, top target at quarterback for a long time, both under Bill O'Brien and James Franklin. They land him. Adam McLean, a guy they really paid a lot of attention to under Bill O'Brien, James Franklin and his staff put similar emphasis on him, the defensive tackle from Maryland.
they land him. You know, when you look at successful recruiting classes, it's not always a matter of where you get guys. You know, Sterling Jenkins, if you got him the tackle, from four-star tackle from Baldwin out in Pittsburgh, if you got him now or you got him in February, you'd be thrilled as a football program. But because you're getting the guy at the top of your board, and Sterling Jenkins was a top tackle on Penn State's board for the class of 2015. So I think the biggest thing is, you know, if you're going to be a successful recruiting class, yeah, you have to get like guys locked up and keep them. And, of course, the earlier you do that, the better chance you have of doing so. But at the same time, if they're not the guys at your top of your board, it's sort of moot because you're obviously not getting what you believe to be the best players to help your team going forward. Penn State's done that so far, and almost all the guys they've taken have been top-of-the-board guys. And if you do that and your evaluation's right, you know, you're in for success down the road. And it's not to say that Penn State's, you know, not been able to do that in the past, but it's certainly they've done it at a rate so far here in 2014 that has far surpassed anything that they've done much in the past.
All right. And now, what numbers-wise, if it stays where it is, and we don't know if it's going to stay where it is, but if it stays where it is, Penn State will be allowed 80 scholarship players next year. Now, the max they could sign is 25, obviously. How many can, based on your numbers, can they sign if the numbers stayed at 80 and no one left?
We're holding steady. You know, we've been holding steady about 20 right now. If no one leaves, you know, if no one leaves, they'd be at around 17, I think, would be the number they could get. But, you know, expecting a few guys naturally leave, as that happens every single year, whether it's at the end of spring, whether it's at the end of summer, whether it's after the season, you know, usually you have a couple guys go. So we're sort of sitting on 20 right now, barring no NCAA changes. Of course, you know, if something would change there, they would have more room. Mm-hmm. But for right now, 20 is sort of the number we're expecting. And, of course, they're at 16. So now you see what happens. I mean, now you have to see what your biggest needs are, how long you can wait for guys. And where it gets interesting for Penn State now is that they've got a lot of the guys that were not only at the top of their board but ready to decide. Now we're at the guys that are at the top of the board but aren't really planning to decide until after their senior season. Why is that good for Penn State? Well, because they will have time to assess where their numbers stand and see what they have to do to fill any additional spots they may get or see what guys they can take once they have the numbers figured out. So I think Penn State's in a good spot right now. I think you'd really be hard-pressed to find them a better spot. You know, they obviously still would probably like another tackle. They'd probably like an outside linebacker if it fits, and another offensive tackle as well. But until they get their numbers on firm ground, I think if you're a Penn State fan, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a better class and a class that meets expectations at this point in May anywhere else in the country.
Finally, Greg, what is this is the off-season. What is your off-season like?
It slows down a little bit. I mean, it ebbs and flows. You know, a lot of it now is draft-heavy. Then it gets into the summer camp circuit, and that's really one of the things that sort of, they sometimes go unnoticed because people are on vacation, they're not reading as much. But, you know, the camp circuit is where we are really able to get an eye on kids. I know there's contention by all sort of sides about recruiting rankings and stars. And at the end of the day, you know, I'm sure from a publicity standpoint, schools like to claim they're this number, that number, have this many, this star, and that, and whatever. But at the end of the day, they don't matter, but it is nice when we're able to put a name with a face with these kids like we're able to do when they go to camps, including Penn State's in the summer and other camps around the country, whether it be Nike or what have you, and just sort of get an eye and see what these kids are actually able to do and sort of get a feel for why Penn State evaluates them. So a lot of travel in the summer, you know, heading to a 7-on-7 next week at Westchester, probably a Nike camp sometime in June. So a lot of travel in the off season, seeing some recruits, and you know, just keeping tabs on things. Obviously, this summer will be a little bit different, considering Penn State starts its season in Ireland. But yeah, nothing too far out of the ordinary. Pretty same old, same old.
Well, if you run a great 40 time at the Nike camp, let us know.
I will. I will do that.
Greg, thanks so much. Appreciate the time as always and your insight.
All right, Steve. Thanks for having me on. Talk to you guys soon.
And that's Greg Pickle from Fight On State. As we wrap it up for today, Vince Welsh, by the way, is going to be joining us tomorrow from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
nice addendum to having after having Paul Page on yesterday. And we're going to have Scott Goodyear on next week to round out our Indy 500 coverage. Dick Girardi on Friday on the Preakness Stakes. We're going to talk to Dick about California Chrome and also the new speed in the race and so forth. We'll have DJ on the show to talk about the Preakness on Friday to go with Tony DeFazio, the Pittsburgh Sports Reporter. I mentioned Kurt Smith already being on the show tomorrow. Besides Vince Welsh tomorrow, we'll have Vince on at 3:35, 4:06 tomorrow. Tony Knopp will be on, the CEO of Spotlight Ticket Management, to talk about the business of sports. So pretty active here heading into the weekend. But again, we'll get Dick Girardi on to talk about the Preakness on Friday. And can California Chrome do it? California Chrome, in a lot of ways, dominated the Kentucky Derby at a mile and a quarter. This time, less traffic and a mile and 3/16. One would think that, you know, he's going to be the heavy favorite. You know, and I'm going to say that there's a good chance that he's going to be under the number. In other words, instead of being like 2-1, he might be 1-2, something like that. But he'll have new. He'll have some of the same competition. There's obviously new competition in this race and some speed in this race as well, because the time at the Kentucky Derby was pedestrian. It was a slow run. Just file it away. But we'll talk to DJ coming up on Friday about that. Hope you enjoyed today's show. And thanks to Josh Moyer, Charlie Wilmoth, and also Greg Pickle, Vince Welsh, and Tony Knopp tomorrow on News Radio 1070 WKOK.